I can hear the accusations of bad taste and exploitation already, smiles Fancourt. I dare say the themes of lost friendship, of a last chance to talk, to explain and make amends may make an appearance in due course. But Owen's murder has already been treated fictionally by himself. He is one of the few to have read the notorious manuscript that appears to have formed the blueprint of the murder. I read it the very day that Quine's body was discovered. My publisher was very keen for me to see it. I'm portrayed in it, you see. He seems genuinely indifferent about his inclusion, however insulting the portrait may have been. I wasn't interested in calling in lawyers. I deplore censorship. What did he think of the book in literary terms? It's what Nabokov called a maniac's masterpiece, he replies, smiling. There may be a case for publishing it in due course, who knows? He can't, surely, be serious. But why shouldn't it be published? Demands Fancourt. Art is supposed to provoke. By that standard alone, Bombyx Mori has more than fulfilled its remit. Yes, why not? Asks the literary punk, ensconced in his Elizabethan manner. With an introduction by Michael Fancourt, I suggest. Stranger things have happened, replies Michael Fancourt with a grin. Much stranger.
Christ almighty, muttered Strike,
throwing the Times back onto Robin's desk and narrowly missing the Christmas tree. Did you see he only claims to have read Bombyx Mori the day you found Quine?
Yeah, said Strike.
He's lying, said Robin.
We think he's lying, Strike corrected her.
Holding fast to his resolution not to waste any more money on taxis, but with the snow still falling, Strike took the number 29 bus through the darkening afternoon. It ran north, taking Strike on a 20-minute journey through the recently gritted roads. A haggard woman got on at Hampstead Road, accompanied by a small, grizzling boy. Some sixth sense told Strike that the three of them were headed in the same direction, and, sure enough, both he and the woman stood to get out in Camden Road, alongside the bare flank of HMP Holloway.
"You're gonna see Mummy," she told her charge,
whom Strike guessed to be her grandson, though she looked around 40. Surrounded by bare-limbed trees and grass verges covered in thick snow, the jail might have been a red-brick university faculty, but for authoritarian signs in government-issue blue and white, and the 16-foot-high doors set into the wall so that prison vans might pass. Strike joined a trickle of visitors, several of them with children, who strained to make marks in the untouched snow heaped beside the paths. The line shuffled together past the terracotta walls with their cement frets, past the hanging baskets, now balls of snow in the freezing December air. The majority of his fellow visitors were women. Strike was unique among the men, not merely for his size, but for the fact that he did not look as though life had pummeled him into a quiescent stupor. A heavily tattooed youth in sagging jeans walked ahead of him, staggered a little with every step. Strike had seen neurological damage back in Selly Oak, but guessed that this kind had not been sustained under mortar fire. The stout female prison officer, whose job it was to check IDs, examined his driver's license, then stared up at him.
"I know who you are," she said, with a piercing look.
Strike wondered whether Anstis had asked to be tipped off if he went to see Leonora. It seemed probable. He had arrived deliberately early, so as not to waste a minute of his allotted time with his client. This foresight permitted him a coffee in the visitors' centre, which was run by a children's charity. The room was bright and almost cheerful, and many of the kids greeted the trucks and teddies as old friends. Strike's haggard companion from the bus watched, gaunt and impassive, as the boy with her played with an action man around Strike's large feet, treating him like a massive piece of sculpture.
Tisiphone, the Avenger of Murder.
He was called through to the visitors' hall at 6 on the dot. Footsteps echoed off the shiny floors. The walls were of concrete blocks, but bright murals painted by the prisoners did their best to soften the cavernous space, which echoed with the clang of metal and keys and the murmur of talk. The plastic seats were fixed either side of a small, low central table, similarly immovable, so as to minimize contact between prisoner and visitor and prevent the passing of contraband. A toddler wailed. Warders stood around the walls, watching. Strike, who had only ever dealt with male prisoners, felt a repugnance for the place, unusual in him. The kids, staring at gaunt mothers, the subtle signs of mental illness in the fiddling and twitching of bitten fingers, drowsy, over-medicated women curled in their plastic seats, were quite unlike the male detention facilities with which he was familiar. Leonora sat waiting, tiny and fragile, pathetically glad to see him. She was wearing her own clothes, a loose sweatshirt, and trousers in which she looked shrunken.
"Orlando's been in," she said.
Her eyes were bright red. He could tell that she'd been crying for a long time.
"Didn't want to leave me. They dragged her out. Wouldn't let me calm her down."
Where she would have shown defiance and anger, he could hear the beginnings of institutionalized hopelessness. 48 hours had taught her that she had lost all control and power.
"Leonora, we need to talk about that credit card statement."
"I never had that card," she said, her white lips trembling. "Owen always kept it. I never had it except sometimes if I needed to go to the supermarket. He always gave me cash."
Strike remembered that she had come to him in the first place because money was running out.
"I left all our finances up to Owen, that's how I liked it. But he was careless. He never used to check his bills nor his bank statements. He used to just sling them in his office. I used to say to him, 'You want to check those? Somebody could be diddling you.' But he never cared. He'd give anything to Orlando to draw on. That's why he'd had her picture."
"Never mind the picture.
Somebody other than you or Owen must have had access to that credit card. We're going to run through a few people, okay?"
"All right,"
she mumbled, cowed.
"Elizabeth Tassel supervised work on the house in Telgarth Road, right? How was that paid for? Did she have a copy of your credit card?"
"No,"
said Leonora. "Are you sure?"
"Yeah, I'm sure. 'Cause we offered it to her and she said it was easier just to take it out of Owen's next royalties, 'cause he was due some any time. He sells well in Finland, I don't know why, but they like his—"
"You can't think of any time where Elizabeth Tassel did something for the house and had the Visa card."
"No,"
she said, shaking her head.
"Never."
"Okay," said Strike. "Can you remember, and take your time, any occasion when Owen paid for something with his credit card at Roper Chard?"
And to his astonishment she said,
"Not Roper Chard exactly, but yeah. They were all there. I was there too. It was, I dunno, 2 years ago. Maybe less. A big dinner for publishers it was at the Dorchester. They put me and Owen at a table with all the junior people. Daniel Chard and Jerry Waldegrave were nowhere near us. Anyway, there was a silent auction, you know, when you write down your bid for—"
"Yeah, I know how they work," said Strike, trying to contain his impatience.
"It was for some writer's charity when they try and get writers out of prison. And Owen bid on a weekend in his country house hotel, and he won it, and he had to give his credit card details at the dinner. Some of the young girls from the publishers were there all tarted up, taking payment. He gave the girl his card."
"I remember that because he was pissed," she said, with a shadow of her former sullenness.
"And he paid 800 quid for it, showing off, trying to make out he earned money like the others."
He handed his credit card over to a girl from the publishers, repeated Strike. Did she take the details at the table, or...
She couldn't make her little machine work, said Leonora. She took it away and brought it back.
Anyone else there you recognized?
Michael Fancourt was there with his publisher, she said, on the other side of the room. That was before he moved to Roper Chard.
Did he and Owen speak?
Not likely, she said.
Right, what about...
he said, and hesitated. They had never before acknowledged the existence of Catherine Kent.
His girlfriend could have got it at any time, couldn't she?
Said Leonora, as though she had read his mind.
You knew about her? He asked, matter of fact.
Police said something, replied Leonora, her expression bleak. There's always been someone, where he was, picking him up at his writing classes. I used to give him right tellings off. When they said he was tied up.
She had started to cry again.
I knew it must have been a woman what done it. He liked that, got him going.
You didn't know about Catherine Kent before the police mentioned her?
I saw her name on a text on his phone one time, but he said it was nothing. Said she was just one of his students, like he always said. Told me he'd never leave us, me and Orlando.
She wiped her eyes under her outdated glasses with the back of a thin, trembling hand.
But you never saw Catherine Kent until she came to the door to say that her sister had died.
Was that her, was it?
Asked Leonora, sniffing and dabbing at her eyes with her cuff.
Fat, ain't she? Well, she could have got his credit card details any time, couldn't she? Taken out of his wallet while he was sleeping.
It was going to be difficult to find and question Catherine Kent, Strike knew. He was sure she would have absconded from her flat to avoid the attentions of the press.
The things the murderer bought on the card, he said, changing tack, were ordered online. You haven't got a computer at home, have you?
Owen never liked him. He preferred his old type.
Have you ever ordered shopping over the internet?
Yeah,
she replied, and his heart sank a little. He had been hoping that Leonora might be that almost mythical beast, a computer virgin.
Where did you do that?
Edna's. She let me borrow hers to order Orlando an art set for her birthday, so I didn't have to go into town,
said Leonora. Doubtless the police would soon be confiscating and ripping apart the kind-hearted Edna's computer. A woman with a shaved head and a tattooed lip on the next table began shouting at a warder, who had warned her to stay in her seat. Leonora cowered away from the prisoner as she erupted into obscenities and the officer approached.
Leonora, there's one last thing, said Strike loudly, as the shouting at the next table reached a crescendo. Did Owen say anything to you about meaning to go away, to take a break, before he walked out on the 5th?
No, she said. Of course not.
The prisoner at the next table had been persuaded to quieten down. Her visitor, a woman similarly tattooed, and only slightly less aggressive-looking, gave the prison officer the finger as she walked away.
You can't think of anything Owen said or did that might have suggested he was planning to go away for a while, Strike persisted, as Leonora watched their neighbours with anxious, owl-like eyes.
What?
She said distractedly.
No, he never tells. Told me. Always just went. If he knew he was going, why wouldn't he say goodbye?
She began to cry, one thin hand over her mouth.
What's going to happen to Dodo if they keep me in prison?
She asked him through her sobs.
Edna can't have her forever. She can't handle her. She went and left Cheeky Monkey behind and Dodo had done some pictures for me.
And after a disconcerted moment or two, Strike decided that she must be talking about the plush orangutan that Orlando had been cradling on his visit to their house.
If they make me stay here,
I'm going to get you out, said Strike, with more confidence than he felt. But what harm would it do to give her something to hold on to? Something to get her through the next 24 hours? Their time was up. He left the hall without looking back, wondering what it was about Leonora, faded and grumpy, 50 years old, with a brain-damaged daughter and a hopeless life, that had inspired in him this fierce determination, this fury.
Because she didn't do it, came the simple answer. Because she's innocent.
In the last 8 months, a stream of clients had pushed open the engraved glass door bearing his name, and the reasons they had sought him had been uncannily similar. They had come because they wanted a spy, a weapon, a means of redressing some balance in their favour or of divesting themselves of inconvenient connections. They came because they sought an advantage, because they felt they were owed retribution or compensation. Because, overwhelmingly, they wanted more money. But Leonora had come to him because she wanted her husband to come home. It had been a simple wish born of weariness and of love. If not for the errant quine, then for the daughter who missed him. For the purity of her desire, Strike felt he owed her the best he could give. The cold air outside the prison tasted different. It had been a long time since Strike had been in an environment where following orders was the backbone of daily life. He could feel his freedom as he walked, leaning heavily on the stick, back towards the bus stop. At the back of the bus, three drunken young women wearing headbands from which reindeer antlers protruded were singing, "They say it's unrealistic, but I believe in you, Saint Nick."
Bloody Christmas, thought Strike,
thinking irritably of the presents he would be expected to buy for his nephews and godchildren, none of whose ages he could ever remember. The bus groaned on through the slush and the snow. Lights of every colour gleamed blurrily at Strike through the steamed-up bus window. Scowling, with his mind on injustice and murder, he effortlessly and silently repelled anyone who might have considered sitting in the seat beside him. Chapter 40. Be glad thou art unnamed. 'Tis not worth the owning. Francis Beaumont and John Fletcher, The False One. Sleet, rain and snow pelted the office windows in turn the following day. Miss Brocklehurst's boss turned up at the office around midday to view confirmation of her infidelity. Shortly after Strike had bidden him farewell, Caroline Ingalls arrived. She was harried, on her way to pick up her children from school, but determined to give Strike the card for the newly opened Golden Lace Gentlemen's Club and Bar that she had found in her husband's wallet. Mr. Ingalls's promise to stay well away from lap dancers, call girls and strippers had been a requirement of their reconciliation. Strike agreed to stake out Golden Lace to see whether Mr. Ingalls had again succumbed to temptation. By the time Caroline Ingalls had left, Strike was very ready for the pack of sandwiches waiting for him on Robin's desk, but he had barely taken a mouthful when his phone rang. Aware that their professional relationship was coming to a close, his brunette client was throwing caution to the winds and inviting Strike out to dinner. Strike thought he could see Robin smiling as she ate her sandwich, determinedly facing her monitor. He tried to decline with politeness, at first pleading his heavy workload, and finally telling her that he was in a relationship. "You never told me that," she said, suddenly cold.
"I like to keep my private and professional life separate," he said.
She hung up halfway through his polite farewell. "Maybe you should have gone out with her," said Robin innocently, "just to make sure she'll pay her bill."
"She'll bloody pay," growled Strike, making up for lost time by cramming half a sandwich into his mouth.
The phone buzzed. He groaned and looked down to see who had texted him.
His stomach contracted. "Leonora?" asked Robin, who had seen his face fall. Strike shook his head, his mouth full of sandwich. The message comprised three words. "It was yours." He had not changed his numbers since he had split up with Charlotte. Too much hassle when 100 professional contacts had it. This was the first time she had used it in 8 months. Strike remembered Dave Polworth's warning. "You be on the watch, Diddy, for signs of her galloping back over the horizon. Wouldn't be surprised if she bolts." Today was the third, he reminded himself. She was supposed to be getting married tomorrow. For the first time since he had owned a mobile phone, Strike wished it had the facility to reveal a caller's location. Had she sent this from the castle of fucking Croy, in an interlude between checking the canapes and the flowers in the chapel? Or was she standing on the corner of Denmark Street, watching his office like Pippa Midgley? Running away from a grand, well-publicized wedding like this would be Charlotte's crowning achievement, the very apex of her career of mayhem and disruption. Strike put the mobile back into his pocket and started on his second sandwich. Deducing that she was not about to discover what had made Strike's expression turn stony, Robin screwed up her empty crisp packet, dropped it in the bin and said, "You're meeting your brother tonight, aren't you?"
"What?"
"Aren't you meeting your brother?"
"Oh, yeah," said Strike. "Yeah."
"At the River Cafe?"
"Yeah."
"It was yours." "Why?" asked Robin.
"Mine, the hell it was, if it even existed."
"What?" said Strike, vaguely aware that Robin had asked him something. "Are you okay?"
"Yeah, I'm fine," he said, pulling himself together.
"What did you ask me?" "Why are you going to the River Cafe?"
"Oh, well," said Strike, reaching for his own packet of crisps. "It's a long shot, but I want to speak to anyone who witnessed Quine and Tassel's row. I'm trying to get a handle on whether he staged it, whether he was planning his disappearance all along."
"You're hoping to find a member of staff who was there that night?" said Robin, clearly dubious.
"Which is why I'm taking Al," said Strike. "He knows every waiter in every smart restaurant in London. All my father's kids do."
When he had finished lunch, he took a coffee into his office and closed the door. Sleet was again spattering his window. He could not resist glancing down into the frozen street, half expecting, hoping, to see her there, long black hair whipping around her perfect pale face, staring up at him, imploring him with her flecked green hazel eyes. But there was nobody in the street except strangers swaddled against the relentless weather. He was crazy on every count. She was in Scotland, and it was much, much better so. Later, when Robin had gone home, he put on the Italian suit that Charlotte had bought him over a year ago, when they had dined at this very restaurant to celebrate his 35th birthday. After pulling on his overcoat, he locked his flat door and set out for the tube in the sub-zero cold, still leaning on his stick. Christmas assailed him from every window he passed. Spangled lights, mounds of new objects, of toys and gadgets, fake snow on glass, and sundry pre-Christmas sale signs, adding a mournful note in the depths of the recession. More pre-Christmas revelers on the Friday night tube. Girls in ludicrously tiny glittering dresses, risking hypothermia for a fumble with the boy from packaging. Strike felt weary and low. The walk from Hammersmith was longer than he had remembered. As he proceeded down Fulham Palace Road, he realized how close he was to Elizabeth Tassel's house. Presumably she had suggested the restaurant, a long way from the Quine's place in Ladbroke Grove, precisely because of its convenience to her. After 10 minutes, Strike turned right and headed through the darkness towards Thames Wharf, through empty, echoing streets, his breath rising in a smoky cloud. The riverside garden that in summer would be full of diners at white tablecloth chairs was buried under thick snow. The Thames glinted darkly beyond the pale carpet, iron-cold and menacing. Strike turned into the converted brick storage facility and was at once subsumed in light, warmth, and noise. There, just inside the door, leaning against the bar with his elbow on its shiny steel surface, was Al, deep in friendly conversation with the barman. He was barely 5'10", which was short for one of Ropey's children, and carrying a little too much weight. His mouse-brown hair was slicked back. He had his mother's narrow jaw, but he had inherited the weak divergent squint that added an attractive strangeness to Rokeby's handsome face and marked Al inescapably as his father's son. Catching sight of Strike, Al let out a roar of welcome, bounced forwards and hugged him. Strike barely responded, being hampered by his stick and the coat he was trying to remove. Al fell back, looking sheepish. "How are you, bruv?" In spite of the comic Anglicism, his accent was a strange mid-Atlantic hybrid that testified to years spent between Europe and America.
"Not bad," said Strike. "You?"
"Yeah, not bad," echoed Al. "Not bad. Could be worse."
He gave a kind of exaggerated Gallic shrug. Al had been educated at La Rose, the international boarding school in Switzerland, and his body language still bore traces of the continental manners he had met there. Something else underlay the response, however, something that Strike felt every time they met. Al's guilt, his defensiveness, a preparedness to meet accusations of having had a soft and easy life compared to his older brother.
"What are you having?" Al asked. "Beer? Fancy a Peroni?"
They sat side by side at the cram bar, facing glass shelves of bottles, waiting for their table. Looking down the long, packed restaurant, with its industrial steel ceiling in stylized waves, its cerulean carpet, and the wood-burning oven at the end like a giant beehive, Strike spotted a celebrated sculptor, a famous female architect, and at least one well-known actor.
"Heard about you and Charlotte," Al said. "Shame."
Strike wondered whether Al knew somebody who knew her. He ran with a jet-set crowd that might well stretch to the future Viscount of Croy.
"Yeah, well," said Strike with a shrug, "for the best."
He and Charlotte had sat here, in this wonderful restaurant by the river, and enjoyed their very last happy evening together. It had taken 4 months for the relationship to unravel and implode, 4 months of exhausting aggression and misery.
"It was yours."
A good-looking young woman whom Al greeted by name showed them to their table. An equally attractive young man handed them menus. Strike waited for Al to order wine and for the staff to depart before explaining why they were there.
"4 weeks ago tonight," he told Al, "a writer called Owen Quine had a row with his agent in here. By all accounts, the whole restaurant saw it. He stormed out and shortly afterwards, probably within days and maybe even that night, he was murdered," said Al, who had listened to Strike with his mouth open. "I saw it in the paper. You found the body."
His tone conveyed a yearning for details that Strike chose to ignore.
"There might be nothing to find out here, but I..."
"His wife did it, though," said Al, puzzled. "They've got her."
"His wife didn't do it," said Strike, turning his attention to the paper menu.
He had noticed before now that Al, who had grown up surrounded by innumerable inaccurate press stories about his father and his family, never seemed to extend his healthy mistrust of British journalism to any other topic. It had had two campuses, Al's school. Lessons by Lake Geneva in the summer months, and then up to Gstaad for the winter, afternoons spent skiing and skating. Al had grown up breathing exorbitantly priced mountain air, cushioned by the companionship of other celebrity children. The distant snarling of the tabloids had been a mere background murmur in his life. This, at least, was how Strike interpreted the little that Al had told him of his youth.
"The wife didn't do it?" said Al, when Strike looked up again.
"No."
"Whoa! You gonna pull another Lula Landry?"
asked Al, with a wide grin that added charm to his off-kilter stare.
"That's the idea," said Strike. "You want me to sound out the staff?"
asked Al.
"Exactly," said Strike.
He was amused and touched by how delighted Al seemed to be at being given the chance to render him service.
"No problem, no problem. Try and get someone decent for you. Where's Lulu gone? She's a smart cookie."
After they had ordered, Al strolled to the bathroom to see whether he could spot the smart Lulu. Strike sat alone, drinking Tianello ordered by Al, watching the white-coated chefs working in the open kitchen. They were young, skilled, and efficient. Flames darted, knives flickered, heavy iron pans moved hither and thither.
"He's not stupid," Strike thought of his brother,
watching Al meander back towards the table, leading a dark girl in a white apron.
"He's just..."
"This is Lulu,"
said Al, sitting back down. "She was here that night." "You remember the argument?" Strike asked her, focusing at once on the girl who was too busy to sit, but stood smiling vaguely at him.
"Oh, yeah," she said. "It was really loud. Brought the place to a standstill."
"Can you remember what the man looked like?"
Strike said, keen to establish that she had witnessed the right row.
"A fat bloke wearing a hat, yeah?" she said, yelling at a woman with grey hair. "Yeah, they had a real bust-up. Sorry, I'm going to have to..."
And she was gone, to take another table's order.
"We'll grab her on the way back," Al reassured Strike. "Eddie sends his best, by the way. Wishes he could have been here."
"How's he doing?"
asked Strike, feigning interest. Where Al had shown himself keen to forge a friendship, his younger brother Eddie seemed indifferent. He was 24 and the lead singer in his own band. Strike had never listened to any of their music.
"He's great," said Al.
Silence fell between them. Their starters arrived and they ate without talking. Strike knew that Al had achieved excellent grades in his international baccalaureate. One evening in a military tent in Afghanistan, Strike had seen a photograph online of 18-year-old Al in a cream blazer with a crest on the pocket, long hair swept sideways and gleaming gold in the bright Geneva sun. Rokeby had had his arm around Al, beaming with paternal pride. The picture had been newsworthy because Rokeby had never been photographed in a suit and tie before.
"Hello, Al," said a familiar voice.
And to Strike's astonishment, there stood Daniel Chard on crutches. His bald head reflecting the subtle spots shining from the industrial waves above them. Wearing a dark red open-neck shirt and a grey suit, the publisher looked stylish among this more bohemian crowd.
"Oh," said Al,
and Strike could tell that he was struggling to place Chard.
"Hi. Dan Chard," said the publisher. "We met when I was speaking to your father about his autobiography."
Oh, yeah,"
said Al, standing up and shaking hands.
"This is my brother, Cormoran."
If Strike had been surprised to see Chard approach Al, it was nothing to the shock that registered on Chard's face at the sight of Strike.
Your brother?"
"Half-brother," said Strike,
inwardly amused by Chard's evident bewilderment. How could the hireling detective be related to the Playboy Prince? The effort it had cost Chard to approach the son of a potentially lucrative subject seemed to have left him with nothing to spare for a three-way awkward silence.
"Leg feeling better?"
Strike asked.
"Oh, yes,"
said Chard. "Much."
"Well, I'll leave you to your dinner."
He moved away, swinging deftly between tables, and resumed his seat where Strike could no longer watch him. Strike and Al sat back down, Strike reflecting on how very small London was once you reached a certain altitude. Once you had left behind those who could not easily secure tables at the best restaurants and clubs.
Couldn't remember who he was, said Al with a sheepish grin.
He's thinking of writing his autobiography, is he? Strike asked.
He never referred to Rokeby as Dad, but tried to remember not to call him Rokeby in front of Al.
Yeah, said Al. They're offering him big money. I don't know whether he's gonna go with that bloke or one of the others. It'll probably be ghosted.
Strike wondered fleetingly how Rokeby might treat his eldest son's accidental conception and disputed birth in such a book. Perhaps, he thought, Rokeby would skip any mention of it. That would certainly be Strike's preference.
He'd still like to meet you, you know, said Al, with an air of having screwed himself up to say it. He's really proud. He read everything about the Landry case.
Yeah, said Strike, looking around the restaurant for Lulu, the waitress who remembered Quine.
Yeah, said Al. So what did he do, interview publishers? Strike asked.
He thought of Catherine Kent, of Quine himself, the one unable to find a publisher, the other dropped, and the aging rock star, able to take his pick.
Yeah, kind of, said Al. I don't know if he's going to do it or not. I think that charred guy was recommended to him.
Who boy?
Michael Fancourt, said Al, wiping his plate of risotto clean with a piece of bread.
Rokeby knows Fancourt? Asked Strike, forgetting his resolution.
Yeah, said Al with a slight frown. Then, let's face it, Dad knows everyone.
It reminded Strike of the way Elizabeth Tassel had said, I thought everyone knew why she no longer represented Fancourt, but there was a difference. To Al, everyone meant the someones, the rich, the famous, the influential. The poor saps who bought his father's music were nobodies, just as Strike had been nobody until he had burst into prominence for catching a killer.
When did Fancourt recommend Roper Chard to...
When did he recommend Chard? Asked Strike.
Dunno, a few months ago, said Al vaguely.
He told Dad he'd just moved there himself, $500,000 advance.
Nice, said Strike.
Told Dad to watch the news, that there'd be a buzz about the place once he moved.
Lulu, the waitress, had moved back into view. Al hailed her again. She approached with a harried expression.
Give me 10, she said, and I'll be able to talk. Just give me 10.
While Strike finished his pork, Al asked about his work. Strike was surprised by the genuineness of Al's interest.
Do you miss the army? Al asked.
Sometimes, admitted Strike.
What are you up to these days?
He felt a vague guilt at not having asked already. Now that he came to think about it, he was not clear how or whether Al had ever earned his living.
Might be going into business with a friend, said Al.
Not working, then, thought Strike.
Bespoke services, leisure opportunities, muttered Al.
Great, said Strike.
Will be if it comes to anything, said Al.
A pause. Strike looked around for Lulu, the whole point of being here, but she was out of sight, busy as Al had probably never been busy in his life.
You've got credibility at least, said Al.
Hmm, said Strike.
Made it on your own, haven't you? Said Al.
What?
Strike realized that there was a one-sided crisis happening at the table. Al was looking at him with a mixture of mingled defiance and envy.
Yeah, well, said Strike, shrugging his large shoulders.
He could not think of any more meaningful response that would not sound superior or aggrieved, nor did he wish to encourage Al in what seemed to be an attempt to have a more personal conversation than they had ever managed.
You're the only one of us who doesn't use it, said Al. Don't suppose it would have helped in the army anyway, would it?
Futile to pretend not to know what it was.
Suppose not, said Strike.
And indeed, on the rare occasions that his parentage had attracted the attention of fellow soldiers, he had met nothing but incredulity, especially given how little he looked like Rokeby. But he thought wryly of his flat on this ice-cold winter night. 2.5 cluttered rooms, ill-fitting window panes. Al would be spending tonight in Mayfair, in their father's staffed house. It might be salutary to show his brother the reality of independence before he romanticized it too much.
Suppose you think this is self-pitying bloody whinging, demanded Al.
Strike had seen Al's graduation photograph online, a bare hour after interviewing an inconsolable 19-year-old private who had accidentally shot his best friend in the chest and neck with a machine gun.
Everyone's entitled to whinge, said Strike.
Al looked as though he might take offense, then reluctantly grinned. Lulu was suddenly beside them, clutching a glass of water and deftly removing her apron with one hand before she sat down with them.
Okay, I've got 5 minutes, she said to Strike without preamble. Al says you want to know about that jerk of a writer.
Yeah, said Strike, focusing at once.
What makes you say he was a jerk?
He loved it, she said, sipping her water.
Loved. Causing a scene. He was yelling and swearing, but it was for show, you could tell. He wanted everyone to hear him. He wanted an audience. He wasn't a good actor.
Can you remember what he said? Asked Strike, pulling out a notebook.
Al was watching excitedly.
There was loads of it. He called the woman a bitch, said she'd lied to him, that he'd put the book out himself and screw her.
But he was enjoying himself, she said. It was fake fury.
And what about Eliz, the woman?
Oh, she was bloody furious, said Lulu cheerfully. She wasn't pretending. The more he ponced about waving his arms and shouting at her, the redder she got. Shaking with anger, she could hardly contain herself. She said something about roping in that stupid bloody woman, and I think it was around then that he stormed out, parking her with the bill, everyone staring at her. She looked mortified. I felt awful for her.
Did she try and follow him?
No. She paid and then went into the loo for a bit. I wondered whether she was crying, actually. Then she left.
That's very helpful, said Strike. You can't remember anything else they said to each other.
Yeah, said Lulu calmly. He shouted, all because of Fancourt and his limp fucking dick.
Strike and Al stared at her.
All because of Fancourt and his limp fucking dick, repeated Strike.
Yeah, said Lulu. That was the bit that made the restaurant go quiet.
You can see why it would, commented Al with a snigger.
She tried to shout him down. She was absolutely incensed, but he wasn't having any of it. He was loving the attention, lapping it up. Look, I've got to get going, said Lulu. Sorry.
She stood up and retied her apron.
See you, Al.
She did not know Strike's name, but smiled at him as she bustled away again. Daniel Chard was leaving. His bald head had reappeared over the crowd, accompanied by a group of similarly aged and elegant people, all of them walking out together, talking, nodding to each other. Strike watched them go with his mind elsewhere. He did not notice the removal of his empty plate.
All because of Fancourt and his limp-fucking dick. Odd. I can't shake this mad bloody idea that Owen did it to himself, that he staged it.
You are right, bruv? Asked Al.
A note with a kiss? Payback time for both of us.
Yeah,
said Strike.
Load of gore and arcane symbolism. Stoke that man's vanity and you could get him to do anything you wanted. 2 hermaphrodites, 2 bloody bags. A beautiful lost soul. That's what he said to me. The silkworm was a metaphor for the writer, who has to go through agonies to get at the good stuff.
Like the turning lid that finds its thread, a multitude of disconnected facts revolved in Strike's mind and slid suddenly into place, incontrovertibly correct, unassailably right. He turned his theory around and around. It was perfect, snug, and solid. The problem was that he could not yet see how to prove it.
Chapter 41.
Thinkest thou my thoughts are lunacies of love? No, they are brands fired in Pluto's forge. Robert Greene, Orlando Furioso.
Strike rose early next morning after a night of broken sleep, tired, frustrated, and edgy. He checked his phone for messages before showering, and after dressing, then went downstairs into his empty office, irritated that Robin was not there on a Saturday, and feeling the absence, unreasonably, as a mark of her lack of commitment. She would have been a useful sounding board this morning. He would have liked company after his revelation of the previous evening. He considered phoning her, but it would be infinitely more satisfying to tell her face to face rather than doing it over the telephone, particularly if Matthew were listening in. Strike made himself tea, but let it grow cold while he pored over the quine file. The sense of his impotence ballooned in the silence. He kept checking his mobile. He wanted to do something, but he was completely stymied by lack of official status, having no authority to make searches of private property or to enforce the cooperation of witnesses. There was nothing he could do until his interview with Michael Fancourt on Monday. Unless... ought he to call Anstis and lay his theory before him? Strike frowned, running thick fingers through his dense hair, imagining Anstis's patronizing response. There was literally not a shred of evidence. All was conjecture. But I'm right, thought Strike with easy arrogance, and he screwed up. Anstis had neither the wit nor the imagination to appreciate a theory that explained every oddity in the killing, but which would seem to him incredible compared to the easy solution, riddled with inconsistencies and unanswered questions, though the case against Leonora was. Explain, Strike demanded of an imaginary Anstis, why a woman smart enough to spirit away his guts without trace would have been dumb enough to order ropes and a burqa on her own credit card. Explain why a mother with no relatives, whose sole preoccupation in life is the well-being of her daughter, would risk a life sentence. Explain why, after years of accommodating Quine's infidelity and sexual quirks to keep their family together, she suddenly decided to kill him. But to the last question, Anstis might just have a reasonable answer. That Quine had been on the verge of leaving his wife for Catherine Kent. The author's life had been well insured. Perhaps Leonora would have decided that financial security as a widow would be preferable to an uncertain hand-to-mouth existence while her feckless ex squandered money on his second wife. A jury would buy that version of events, especially if Catherine Kent took the stand and confirmed that Quine had promised to marry her. Strike was afraid that he had blown his chance with Catherine Kent, turning up unexpectedly on her doorstep as he had, in retrospect, a clumsy, inept move. He had scared her, looming out of the darkness on her balcony, making it only too easy for Pippa Midgley to paint him as Leonora's sinister stooge. He ought to have proceeded with finesse, eased himself into her confidence the way he had done with Lord Parker's PA. So that he could extract confessions like teeth under the influence of concerned sympathy, instead of jackbooting to her door like a bailiff. He checked his mobile again. No messages. He glanced at his watch. It was barely 9:30. Against his will, he felt his attention tugging to be free of the place where he wanted and needed it, on Quine's killer,
and the things that must be done to secure an arrest, to the 17th century chapel in the castle of Croy. She would be getting dressed, no doubt, in a bridal gown costing thousands. He could imagine her naked in front of the mirror, painting her face. He had watched her do it 100 times, wielding the makeup brushes in front of dressing table mirrors, hotel mirrors, so acutely aware of her own desirability that she almost attained unself-consciousness. Was Charlotte checking her phone as the minutes slipped by? Now that the short walk up the aisle was so close, now that it felt like the walk along a gangplank, was she still waiting, hoping, for a response from Strike to her 3-word message of yesterday? And if he sent an answer now, what would it take to make her turn her back on the wedding dress? He can imagine it hanging like a ghost in the corner of her room, and pull on her jeans, throw a few things in a hold-all, and slip out of a back door. Into a car, her foot flat to the floor, heading back south to the man who had always meant escape.
"Fuck this," Strike muttered.
He stood up, shoved the mobile in his pocket, threw back the last of his cold tea, and pulled on his overcoat. Keeping busy was the only answer. Action had always been his drug of choice. Sure, though, he was that Catherine Kent would have decamped to her friends now that the press had found her, and notwithstanding the fact that he regretted turning up unannounced on her doorstep, he returned to Clem Attlee Court only to have his suspicions confirmed. Nobody answered the door. The lights were off, and all seemed silent within. An icy wind blew along the brick balcony. As Strike moved away, the angry-looking woman from next door appeared, this time eager to talk.
"She's gone away. You press, are you?"
"Yeah," said Strike, because he could tell the neighbour was excited at the idea, and because he did not want Kent to know that he had been back.
"The things your lot have written," she said, with poorly disguised glee. "The things you've said about her. Nah, she's gone."
"Any idea when she'll be back?"
"Nah,"
said the neighbour with regret. Her pink scalp was visible through the sparse, tightly permed grey hair.
"I could call you," she suggested, "if she shows up again."
"That'd be very helpful," said Strike.
His name had been in the papers a little too recently to hand over one of his cards. He tore out a page of his notebook, wrote his number out for her, and handed it over with a £20 note.
"Cheers,"
she said, businesslike.
"See ya."
He passed a cat on his way back downstairs, the same one, he was sure, at which Catherine Kent had taken a kick. It watched him with wary but superior eyes as he passed. The gang of youths he had met previously had gone. Too cold today if your warmest item of clothing was a sweatshirt. Limping through the slippery grey snow required physical effort, which helped distract his busy mind, making moot the question of whether he was moving from suspect to suspect on Leonora's behalf or Charlotte's. Let the latter continue towards the prison of her own choosing. He would not call. He would not text. When he reached the tube, he pulled out his phone and telephoned Jerry Waldegrave. He was sure that the editor had information that Strike needed, that he had not known he needed before his moment of revelation in the River Cafe, but Waldegrave did not pick up. Strike was not surprised. Waldegrave had a failing marriage, a moribund career, and a daughter to worry about. Why take a detective's calls, too? Why complicate your life when it did not need complicating, when you had a choice? The cold, the ringing of unanswered phones, silent flats with locked doors. He could do nothing else today. Strike bought a newspaper and went to the Tottenham, sitting himself beneath one of the voluptuous women painted by a Victorian set designer, cavorting with Flora in their flimsy draperies. Today,
Strike felt strangely as though he was in a waiting room, whiling away the hours. Memories like shrapnel forever embedded, infected by what had come later. Words of love and undying devotion, times of sublime happiness. Lies upon lies upon lies. His attention kept sliding away from the stories he was reading. His sister Lucy had once said to him in exasperation, "Why do you put up with it? Why? Just because she's beautiful?" And he had answered, "It helps." She had expected him to say no, of course. Though they had spent so much time trying to make themselves beautiful, you were not supposed to admit to women that beauty mattered. Charlotte was beautiful, the most beautiful woman he had ever seen, and he had never rid himself of a sense of wonder at her looks, nor of the gratitude they inspired, nor of pride by association. "Love," Michael Fancourt had said, "is a delusion." Strike turned the page on a picture of the Chancellor of the Exchequer's sulky face without seeing it. Had he imagined things in Charlotte that had never been there? Had he invented virtues for her to add luster to her staggering looks? He had been 19 when they met. It seemed incredibly young to Strike now, as he sat in this pub carrying a good 2 stone of excess weight, missing half a leg. Perhaps he had created a Charlotte in her own image, who had never existed outside his own besotted mind. But what of it? He had loved the real Charlotte, too. The woman who had stripped herself bare in front of him, demanding whether he could still love her if she did this, if she confessed to this, if she treated him like this. Until finally, she had found his limit, and beauty, rage, and tears had been insufficient to hold him, and she had fled into the arms of another man.
"And maybe that's love," he thought,
siding in his mind with Michael Fancourt against an invisible and censorious Robin, who for some reason seemed to be sitting in judgment on him as he sat drinking Doom Bar and pretending to read about the worst winter on record.
"You and Matthew."
Strike could see it, even if she could not. The condition of being with Matthew was not to be herself. Where was the couple that saw each other clearly? In the endless parade of suburban conformity that seemed to be Lucy and Greg's marriage? In the tedious variations on betrayal and disillusionment that brought a never-ending stream of clients to his door? In the willfully blind allegiance of Leonora Quine to a man whose every fault had been excused because he's a writer? Or the hero worship that Catherine Kent and Pippa Midgley had brought to the same fool, trussed like a turkey and disemboweled? Strike was depressing himself. He was halfway down his third pint. As he wondered whether he was going to have a fourth, his mobile buzzed on the table where he had laid it, face down. He drank his beer slowly while the pub filled up around him, looking at his phone, taking bets against himself.
"Outside the chapel, giving me one last chance to stop it, or she's done it and wants to let me know."
He drank the last of his beer before flipping the mobile over. "Congratulate me, Mrs. Jago Ross." Strike stared at the words for a few seconds, then slid the phone into his pocket, got up, folded the newspaper under his arm, and set off home. As he walked with the aid of his stick back to Denmark Street, he remembered the words from his favourite book, unread for a very long time, buried at the bottom of the box of belongings on his landing. "Difficile est, longum subito, deponere amorem. Difficile est, puerum hoc qua lubet efficias." It is hard to throw off long-established love. Hard, but this you must manage somehow. The restlessness that had consumed him all day had gone. He felt hungry and in need of relaxation.
Arsenal were playing Fulham at 3. There was just time to cook himself a late lunch before kick-off. And after that, he thought, he might go round to see Nina Lascelles. Tonight was not a night.